So this morning we're going to be looking at Judah in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. And the books that were kind of finalised in that period. The most dominant external factor is the arising of Greece. We've already seen in the 5th century names that are probably familiar to you all, Thermopylae and Marathon and Salamis and the Athenian army and the Egyptians and Persian navies fighting in the Mediterranean. That was kind of going on. But then later with Macedonia and Philip, Alexander the Great, the son of Philip, the whole invasion of the Greek world into this area happens. But that's at the in the last third of the 4th century. So we're actually beginning with the last years of the Persian rule in Judah, from 400 through to 331. We'll begin with the reign of Artaxerxes II, from 404 to 359 BC. Sparta, having defeated Athens in the Peloponnesian War, which lasted right through that period, mounted a number of expeditions to liberate the Greek cities from Persian rule. The Spartan navy, however, was destroyed at Cnidus in 394 BC, thereby giving the Persians mastery of the Aegean. In 386, Artaxerxes II established direct rule over the Greek cities of Asia Minor, what we'd call the western coast of Turkey. After many reversals, especially against Egypt, by the end of his reign, that's the middle of the 4th century, the Persian Empire was intact. Had a lot of struggles, but it's held on. A number of assassinations followed the death of Artaxerxes II. His son, Artaxerxes III, emerged triumphant, having killed most of his relatives. Persia suffered a new defeat at the hand of Egypt in 351 to 350. The Phoenician cities revolted the following year. In 345, Sidon had to surrender to the Persian fleet. In 343, the Persian army won a victory in Egypt. And so, around 340, the Persian Empire had recovered its territorial boundaries. So I'm just giving you the impression of a lot of struggling going on at this time. Darius III, who reigned in Persia from 336 through to the time of Alexander the Great, 330, was the last king of the Achaemenid, the first Persian Empire. In 334 BC, Alexander the Great began his invasion and subsequently defeated the Persians in a number of battles before looting and destroying the capital of the Persian Empire, Persepolis. This marked the beginning of Greek control of the empire. We have no evidence of any effects of this whole two-thirds of a century of struggle between Persia and Greece, or Macedonia, of course. We have no evidence from anywhere of how that affected Judah. Let's look at some books that seem to have come to their final form, and I've already got to use a final with inverted commas, because work still goes on. But in general, the Book of Proverbs, with ancient material, is likely to have hit the press, as we say, in the last years of Persian rule. It's a collection of wise sayings, some of which are as old as Israel itself, as you'd expect in wise sayings that come through families. The oldest sections of the books of Proverbs are the collections found in section 2 which is from 10 to 22, and section 4, which is 25 to 29. Most of these wise sayings are simply that. They state a value that sheds light on behaviour that's considered appropriate in a particular area of personal or social activity. Some examples from chapter 4. More than all else, guard your heart. From it flow the springs of life. We could well reflect on that ourselves today. It's as wise now as it was then. Chapter 10. A wise child makes a father content. A foolish child is a mother's grief. Some, but a relatively small number, of these wise sayings can be categorized as proverbs. That's the title for the whole book, but there are very few proverbs in it. A proverb is drawn from experience and makes obvious sense, but the lesson it presents is not found in its literal meaning. In English, I've given you an example. A stitch in time saves nine. It has nothing much to do with sowing. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Has little to do with looking for birds. It's got a wider, clearly, it's a metaphor. Here's some examples from the book of Proverbs, chapter 1. No difference if the net is baited while the bird is looking on. Chapter 7. Can fire be carried in the bosom without burning one's clothes? Can one walk on hot coals without scorching the feet? We might have one that's a bit equivalent. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Chapter 14. Where there are no oxen, the manger is empty. Abundant crops come by the strength of the ox that does the ploughing. Some of the sayings and instructions are based on faith in God. We looked at this in general when we looked at the wisdom literature earlier, but I'm giving you just a taste for the book of Proverbs. In Israel, wisdom is seen as a gift of Yahweh. The aim of wisdom is to live a good, productive life. The people of ancient Israel knew that such a life has its source in God the Creator, and has as its goal a life of communion with God. A communion experienced in nature, in the family, in communal living, in the country or city, and in the events of daily life. Here's a couple of examples where they explicitly invoke Yahweh. Chapter 2. It's Yahweh who gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. Chapter 3. Trust in Yahweh with all your heart. Do not rely on your own understanding. As with prophets, so with wise persons, the claim to be a wise person is no guarantee. The claim to be a prophet is no guarantee that you're a prophet. Jeremiah challenged those who claim to be wise as he challenged those who set themselves up as prophets. Here we have Jeremiah chapter 8. How can you say we are wise and the law of Yahweh is with us, when in fact the false pen of the scribes has made it into a lie? The wise shall be put to shame, amazed and taken aback. They've rejected the word of Yahweh. What wisdom is in them? One assumption that appears in all traditional wisdom is that riches are a blessing from God, typical of the whole of the Old Testament. Riches are a blessing from God. Poverty is seen as a punishment for something. Here we have chapter 3. Long life is in wisdom's right hand. In her left are riches and honour. So be wise, and you'll live a long life and have plenty of riches and a reputation in the town. A comment I'm offering: how differently Jesus saw things. The rich man who so wanted to experience the quality of life that was evident in Jesus and his disciples was shocked when Jesus told him to give away his possessions. What? Give away blessings that God has given me because I've been a good person? What's Jesus talking about? When Jesus went on to say to his disciples how hard it will be for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God, his disciples, we're told, were greatly astonished. This is something new, and you don't find it in the book of Proverbs or the other wise books of the Old Testament. It's a different idea of God and a different idea of human freedom. Let's move. Sorry it's so rapid, but you can do it yourselves. Let's move to this astonishing book called Ecclesiastes. This is a penetrating reflection on the nature of true wisdom. In accepting it as inspired, Jews and Christians challenge us to listen for the Spirit of God breathing through the words of someone who introduces his work with the phrase, the words of Kohelet. The word Kohelet derives from the Hebrew word for the assembly, the Kahal. Kohelet means the preacher, the one who speaks in the Kahal, speaks in the assembly, the synagogue. Kohelet wishes to remain anonymous, for when we're listening to Kohelet, the author, reflecting on wisdom, we're expected to reflect on our own experience as members of God's Kahal, God's chosen people, assembled for worship and communion. In the Greek version, Kohelet is translated Ecclesiastes, and you might know enough Latin to pick that up, or Greek. Ecclesia means the assembly, the Kahal. It's the Greek word for Kahal, the Ecclesia. So Ecclesia means church. So Ecclesiastes means the one who preaches in the church, in the ecclesia. Kohelet is described as we're listening to it or watching it staged, or Ecclesiastes 1 says that Kohelet is the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. So as we listen to the reflection of Kohelet, we are to have before our mind's eye, or better, watch it staged. Sitting center stage is the great Solomon, the wisest of the people of the world. So he's the one speaking, and it's pretending, it's claiming, it's wanting us dramatically to hear the wisest person in the world questioning his wisdom. We're listening to the man whom traditional wisdom has presented as renowned above all for his wisdom, King Solomon. It's the same as we've already seen in the Song of Songs. We're listening to King Solomon, who had 1,000 concubines and whatever and whatever and whatever. And he's reflecting on his life that he's missed out on. Solomon is the exemplar of all the benefits that flow from wisdom as traditionally understood. He was renowned for his power, his wealth, and the astonishing success of all that he undertook. He inherited the golden age created by David and lived it out without battles. It's only at his death that the whole thing broke apart, according to the idealized picture of the Book of Kings. So we're listening to Kohelet, all right, But he wants us to listen to Solomon, reflecting back over his life. And we're challenged to ask ourselves, what did all Solomon's fame really come to in the end? What became of his success, inverted commas, as a builder, of his power and wealth? How wise really was Solomon? The author is challenging much of the traditional understanding of wisdom. How could he do this in a more dramatic way than having the great Solomon centre stage, recognising his failure and questioning the wisdom that had been attributed to him? What a powerful way of an author questioning traditional wisdom. And the book of Proverbs included. Now, we want to, this is the nearest I can get, to look at the social situation in this first half of the 4th century BC, in which this book is emerging. And we have to go back a century, admittedly, but this still applies pretty well. We go back to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 5, and this is how what we read there, because the book itself was written about this time. The experience is middle of the earlier century, but now this book is emerging here too. There were also those, we read in the book of Nehemiah chapter 5, there were also those who said, we are having to pledge our fields, our vineyards, our houses in order to get grain during the famine. And there are those who said, we're having to borrow money on our fields and vineyards to pay the king's tax. Now our flesh is the same as that of our kindred. Our children are the same as their children. And yet we're forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have been ravished. We're powerless. Our fields and vineyards now belong to others. That's the situation that all this literature has been written in. The economic environment favoured the political elite and the most influential entrepreneurs. In consequence, the gap between rich and dependent classes is widening. The prevailing insecurity and the difficulty of being economically self-sufficient in the new commercial environment that depended on variability of inter-province trade encouraged a mentality that fostered striving to have more but never feeling secure, and so never being satisfied with what we have. Sounds a bit modern, doesn't it? There was a tendency for those who made it to criticise the poor as being responsible for their own condition. God, we've heard that. The legal system favoured the prosperous, so that justice was elusive. Greed and ambition flourished. People had to be careful in what they criticised. As reports got back to those who exercised power in the land, there was a prevailing fear of the arbitrary power wielded by rulers. One of the factors that is spoken about, not in the Bible particularly, but everywhere else, about the Persian reign and why it was so successful is they had spies in every city, reporting back to the satrap. So if you said something against the government, they'd be stamping right on you. So there's this powerlessness and not able to kind of break free. The author is well aware of the complexities and ambiguities, the author of Ecclesiastes, we're still talking about, was well aware of the complexities and ambiguities of the human condition. We'll notice him supporting values only to add the rider. Yes, this is a value, but don't expect that following it will lead to success, because it hasn't anywhere around the place, if we're honest, he's saying. He offers guidelines, fully aware that they won't always help. It's very modern stuff, this critique. The author is aware of the responsibility of human beings for bringing about the sufferings that we experience. He's critical of the greedy landowners and generally of those who wield power in the land. He also recognizes that his readers are free to welcome or neglect the joy that God is offering them. However, it never occurs to Kohelet, the author, to doubt that it's God and God alone who determines everything that happens in the world. That prevailing assumption is unquestioned even by this very questioning author. That's absolutely taken for granted. Kohelet, the author, will lead us to place our hope in God. But he first requires of us that we face up to the fact that much of what traditional wisdom looked on as a sign of God's blessing is not what it claimed to be. And we're unwise to chase after power, wealth, success, or fame in our undertakings, thinking we can find meaning in them. Solomon didn't. And Kohelet tells us that we won't either. The list, power, wealth, success, should prepare us modern readers to expect that the reflections we hear in Ecclesiastes might have something to say to us. Brackets. Probably because I got carried away, but I actually think my commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes, it's one of my best, because Ecclesiastes is so, it's hard to kind of miss it when you get into it. In Ecclesiastes, we hear the word vanity 27 times. It begins, as you know, vanity of vanities, and all is vanity. The Hebrew word is hebel. Hebel is just a whiff. Everything's like a bit of smoke. It's gone. It's like a cigarette smoke. It comes to nothing. 1 minute it's there, another minute it's gone. Everything is passing, insubstantial. Can't put your trust in it. That is, as he says in chapter 1, verse 3, and don't miss it, everything under the sun. Not everything above the sun, in other words, not God, not the transcendent one, but everything under the sun, everything we experience in our created existence, is hebel. By the way, the word Abel in the story of Genesis, Cain and Abel, is exactly this word. Hebel, because he's there 1 minute and he's gone the next. He's insubstantial, so he's called Abel. Cain, as I think I mentioned earlier, means smithy. It's the city person, the person who has power and can control things and farm and home, not the poor pastoralist who's just wandering around with his sheep. So everything under the sun, everything other than the transcendent and necessarily incomprehensible God, is as fleeting, unpredictable, and unreliable as a puff of smoke. Apart from God, everything we experience is in itself insubstantial. It's deceptive. It's a pretense. It's an illusion. This is true of piety. It's true of righteousness. And it's true of nearly everything that goes under the name of wisdom. All is vanity. So don't put your trust in it. Everything has its place if we see it as a gift of God. If, however, we look to anything other than God to find meaning in our lives, then we lack wisdom. So if we put our hope in reputation, riches, long life, we're just waffling. Ecclesiastes doesn't make this claim. It challenges us to look at our own experience honestly and without evasion and see for ourselves that he's actually right. Ecclesiastes could almost have been written yesterday. It's very unusually modern for an Old Testament text. And that's all I'll say about it here. Hope I've whetted your appetite to go and read it. Another book that emerges, it seems, in the final years of the Persian rule, the early half and a bit more of the 4th century, is the book of Esther. Like the stories in the book of Daniel, Esther is perhaps best described as a court tale. It's set in Susa, which is there just above the Persian Gulf. That's its setting, in the court of Xerxes I, the king of Persia, from 486 to 465 BC. And a Jew living in Susa, far from the land of Judah, rises to be prime minister of the realm, second only to the king. And surely, whoever created this story, you and I can hardly avoid thinking of Joseph becoming the second to the Pharaoh back in Egypt in the ancient stories of the patriarchs. There's a clear parallel there. A Jew living in Susa rises to be prime minister. This is because of the heroic actions of his relative, Esther, who becomes queen of Persia. None of it is historical, by the way. Becomes queen of Persia and intervenes to save her people from an anti-Jewish pogrom. It's possible that the events of one such pogrom form the historical basis of our story. Pogroms have gone on over history. It's a story to demonstrate that there need be no contradiction between being a faithful Jew and being a good citizen in a foreign land. Something that had to be learnt by the people of Yehud while they're under the little tiny landlocked land, while they're a tiny bit of a satrapy which is part of the whopping big Persian Empire. Being in control and having your own king and your own government and your own army is not essential to being a faithful Jew. That's what this is telling us. The story of Esther is making the point that it's by being faithful to your Jewish traditions that you can best support a foreign state. So be part of the state. Contribute to it. Stop fighting about it and looking for alternatives where there's no hope of finding them anyhow. It's interesting that the names of the main characters point to the Eastern origins of this story. For example, Mordecai, the hero of it. You can hear Marduk in there, surely. Marduk is the principal god of Babylonian pantheon. Esther echoes Ishtar, the principal female divinity, celebrated in the fertility and burial cults of Babylon. And Haman, who's the main crook, echoes Human, an Elamite that's on the side of the Persian Gulf god. So the story seems to have come obviously from that part of the world. The book is explicitly linked to the Jewish festival of Purim, which you find mentioned in Esther chapter 9. And since the festival of Purim is not found in the Torah, this story, this tale, provides a historical setting for this feast, which they can't find in their Torah. The origins of the festival are lost in the mists of history, but it may have arisen as a way of Jews celebrating the Persian New Year festival. So they had their own festival. One reason for Jewish reluctance to accept Esther among the inspired books, and it was quite slow to be accepted in their canon, may be that the rabbis were hesitant to include a text that linked to a festival that allowed excessive drinking. If you read, happen to chance read it for a relaxation one day, Purim is a bit over the top when it comes to indulging in the alcohol and so on. And that was probably thought of, and if you want to look up the Talmud, if you can find it, you'll find that put there. So that was an awkward bit of it. The festival Purim gets its name from the lots, Pur, cast by Haman to determine the propitious day for the pogrom, against the Jewish community in Susa. As is the way with religious festivals, Purim picked up other connections in the course of its history, notably the celebration of the death of the Syrian general Nicanor, the hands of Judas the Maccabee way later. Like other Jewish festivals, it's celebrated at the full moon. All their festivals take place on the 14th of the month, and the month, their months, are determined. The shofar is rung out at the first little glimpse of the new moon. That's the beginning of the new moon month. And then the full moon, which we've just had, is the fifth day for all their feasts, as you'd expect, I guess. The 14th day of Adar, our equivalent of March, is called Mordecai's Day. The 13th is Nicanor's Day. Purim celebrates Jewish identity and the conviction that Judaism will survive whatever the circumstances. Now we come to the Greek period, which is the last third of the 4th century and the whole of the 3rd century. So this is the rest of this presentation. The only source we have for any continuous history is Josephus. There's nothing in the Bible about it, and there's nothing anywhere else. So Josephus, who's, they say, is a pretty untrustworthy historian, is our only source. He tends to exaggerate, and he tends to say what will please the reader. But anyhow, he does have a lot of interesting data there. Alexander the Great died in Babylon in 323. His journey took him as far as the Indus River. Look at all this. So he died in Babylon, and the Eastern Empire immediately broke into two rival regions. Egypt, which was taken over by one of his generals, Ptolemy, and the rest of the place, not Macedonia over here, but the rest of this area, was under the rule of Seleucus, another of his generals. So there's a map of the way things looked in the last years of the 4th century and all throughout the 3rd century. That's the Nile that you can see there, Alexandria, named after Alexander, of course. And all through these centuries, 4th and 3rd, this narrow corridor of land here, which is, of course, Canaan, or the Palestine, was controlled from Egypt. So it's the Egyptian dominance there. The rest of it, all the way over here, what we'll call Turkey, Iraq, Iran, right as far as the Indus River, all and Babylon here in the southern, all that is run by the Seleucids. Throughout the 3rd century, Greek trade, language and culture had an increasingly profound effect, especially on the towns, the trading centres of the East. This influence of Greek language and culture is spoken of as Hellenization. Hellen is a word for Greek. And there are different stages in this impact of the Greek world on the people of Judah and the rest of the area. There's close political, military and commercial contact. Intermarriage brings a closer connection. Adoption of the Greek language and culture by those in the East who wanted to make their way in the world, and they had the leisure for travel and study even further, and complete assimilation of Orientalized Greeks and Hellenized Orientals. And the study of the English and British Empire would be a very similar picture that you could talk about. Under the Ptolemies, which is our whole period now for the rest of this presentation, Judah was under Egyptian control, and Alexandria was added to Babylon as a growing centre for Judaism outside Judah. So Babylon remains a big element of Jews there. Now Alexandria becomes a place where they went. Some in Judah embraced Hellenism. They wanted to be part of the prevailing Greek culture. Among these was a leading family, the family of the Ptobiads. Others, including the Oniads, another family, strong family in Judah, determinedly resisted any attempt to water down the Jewish culture. So you've got a divided, what do? Do we fit in with the Greeks, or do we maintain our Judaism and resist it? It was a period of considerable unrest. The rivalry between Egypt and Syria, between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, made Palestine a constant military corridor. There were no fewer than five drawn-out wars during the 3rd century. The Ptolemies maintained their control of this area, but with a lot of difficulty. And if you say war between Syria and Egypt, you're talking about armies trudging up and down the little corridor that we call Canaan, Palestine. Some books that emerge in this early part of the Greek control. The Book of Chronicles. Scholars today tend to see the book of Ezra and Nehemiah as being one of the sources of the Book of Chronicles. It was debated for quite a while, but I think the convergence of probabilities is pointing to that. As part of the attempt to encourage a sense of identity in Judah, the chronicler, we'll call him, set out to rewrite their history, focusing on Israel, as a, Israel meaning the religious community, as a worshipping community, and so on, the Torah and the temple. And this is quite a new thing we're watching. Up till then, you'd have expected them to rewrite the Book of Kings, produced by the Deuteronomists, because that's the way they tended to deal with their literature. But by now, the books of the Bible have become a bit firmer, a bit more static, a bit more complete. So rather than rewrite, they write another book from a different angle, covering from David right through again. So there's a lot of parallels, a lot of quotes, direct quotes from the books of Kings, but a different perspective on it. It's getting near to what we would do. Updating without changing. Like the Deuteronomist, the chronicler still hopes for a restoration of the Davidic dynasty. He quotes 2 Samuel 7:3, where God promises he will establish the throne of David's son forever. And he continues the Davidic genealogy beyond Zerubbabel, which you can't get, of course, because that's the end of the Book of Kings. However, with no signs of immediate restoration, the chronicler places his hopes in the cult, in the worship, as it has been reformed and consolidated in the middle of the 5th century by Ezra and Nehemiah. In what the chronicler adds to the Deuteronomist's account, it's clear that he wants to provide a tradition that traces the worship in the temple in the 3rd century, he wants to trace it right back to David. He sets out to provide proper credentials for those exercising various ministries in the temple, especially the Levites. He sees the renewed cult centering in the temple as fulfilling God's will and as providing an inspiration and a guide to Jewish communities throughout the world. This last point is important for the chronicler. At a time when pressure was being exerted to resist syncretism, Hellenization, and assimilation by promoting an exclusive view of Israel, the Chronicle tried to redress the balance, worshipping God in a way that was faithful to the prescriptions of the cult was essential. But Judah mustn't exclude those who have a rightful claim to participate in it. In the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, Chronicles is positioned last of all the writings. Its final words underline the link between the writings, the prophets, and the Torah. And here I'm reading to you from the last words of the Bible as put together by the Jewish community. Second book of Chronicles, chapter 36, verses 22 and the following. And it reads, "In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in fulfillment of the word of Yahweh spoken to Jeremiah, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of the king Cyrus of Persia, so that he sent a herald throughout all his kingdom, and also declared in a written edict, 'Thus says the king Cyrus of Persia, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may Yahweh his God be with him. Let him go up.'" So it sees there Judah that they're living in as an edict coming from Cyrus. This is the return from the exile. It's when he's finishing his story. Return from the exile, but it's all Yahweh's doing. And he's inspired by Yahweh to do it. Another book that comes from this time is the book of Tobit. It's perhaps best described as a short Jewish romance. What it lacks in suspense, it makes up for in the realism of the characters. Ordinary people who look to God and who care for their neighbour. This doesn't protect them from suffering, but they continue to trust in God, and so they experience God's blessing. It's a quaint story, really. And that's a map of where it takes place. Tobit is a righteous and observant Jew living in Nineveh. The ancient capital of the Assyrian Empire. He gives an account of his experiences. He actually comes from Tisbe in Naphtali, which is in Galilee. And he was exiled along with many of his contemporaries during the reign of the Assyrian king Shalmaneser V, in the latter part of the 8th century BC, as the story is presented. His mother, who's unnamed, and his father, Tobiel — Tov means good in Hebrew, so Tovit, Tovaya, Tobiel, they've all got this good bit in their name — died when he was still a child, and he was raised by his grandmother, Deborah. He married a woman called Hannah, who was also from Naphtali, and they had a son whom they named Tobiah. Tobiah. Yah is Yahweh. God rewards Tobit by making him purchasing agent to the king in Nineveh. With a change of ruler, however, his fortunes change under Sennacherib. But he's again in favour during the reign of King Esarhaddon, thanks to the fact that his nephew, Ahikar, is the king's chief financial minister. As a consequence of his persistence in burying the dead, Tobit loses his sight. He's going out burying the dead, and then he lies down on a hot afternoon in the shade, and a pigeon — so be careful where you lie — a pigeon does what pigeons do, and it landed in his eye and blinded him. His blindness is compounded by having to rely on the support of his wife. Common today, but not in their day. Who challenges his whole reason for living. He sees no purpose in continuing. He, the bread earner, is now having to be looked after. And in desperation, he prays to God to bring his life to an end. There's a change of scene then, and we move from Nineveh in Assyria to Ecbatana in Media. Some 400 k's east of Nineveh, you've got to pass through the Zagros Mountains. There's Nineveh and there's Ecbatana. There's mountains all through there. That place will also be named in the story too, just below the Caspian Sea. We're taken to the home of Raguel, who's living with his wife, Edna, and their daughter, Sarah. Sarah, too, is desperate, just like Tobit. She's been betrothed 7 times, but each time her husband has died before consummating the wedding, the marriage. And she's there, desperate, and she prays for God to end her life. You hear one, and then you hear the other. God answers both their prayers by sending to their aid Raphael. Rapha means heal, and El is God. God the healer. One of the 7 who stand before the throne of God. You know of Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and one goes through the rest. He arrives under the guise of a man who calls himself Azariah. Azariah. Tobit remembers in the story that he's owed money by Gabael, who lives in Rages, in the Elburz Mountains, south of the Caspian Sea. Tobit sends his son Tobiah on a long journey to collect the debt, telling him to stay with Jews and not to marry anyone outside his tribe. Tobiah is accompanied by Raphael, Azariah. Eventually, Tobiah and Sarah meet, and they're married, and it all ends happily ever after. And they travel back to Nineveh, and Tobit's sight is miraculously restored from the liver of a fish they caught in a river, and everyone lives happily ever after. I don't know that you'll be keen to read the book, but if you get a chance, that might at least give you a taste for what you expect. And now, to conclude this section, the Psalms. The Psalms are music. They've come from like a music book that's updated, 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 etc. So I'm only suggesting that it's probably about the 3rd century when it comes together, the 150 Psalms that we know. It's often called, and rightly called, the Songbook of the Second Temple, so the hymn book of the Temple. The Psalms come from every period in the history of the Israelite and Jewish people. Those that centre on the king, obviously, come at least in their basic form from the pre-exilic period, the period of the kings. We're not going to sing about kings now, there's none there. So they belong pre-exilic. Likewise, the Psalms are in praise of Yahweh when the temple was considered Yahweh's abode. The same can be said of the Psalms to Zion, the king's city. Other psalms reflect the period of the exile and the restoration of the temple after the return. It's often difficult to get it exact, but you can see elements in it that clearly belong at different periods. Some psalms show clear signs of editing. I did one with you earlier, the famous Psalm 51, where the part on Jerusalem is obviously stuck on the end of a highly structured psalm. In general, we should expect this, for the prayers were not meant as archive pieces. They would have been updated to make them more suitable for prayer as situations changed. The collection of the 150 Psalms appears to have taken place about 200 BC. The The collection was made, it seems, to create a devotional prayer book for people. Some of the psalms came from and were used in the public cult. Others were of a more personal nature. And now I'm doing something a bit unusual. I actually planned to do a lot more on the psalms. Till this morning when I was sitting at my desk, I realised I'd be going for far too long. So I'm not going to quote when the psalms are quoted in the New Testament. We did slightly bits of that earlier. But I'm now going to look, because it might help us understand inspiration. I'm going to look at verses in the psalms that are not used in the Christian liturgy. Once I read them to you, because you won't find them in your missal, once I read them to you, you will easily see why they're not used. I'm also going to be suggesting that the people who left them out because they don't fit with Christian feeling or understanding were a bit light-handed. They should have left a lot more out, I would suggest. And I'll give you some examples of that, and you can make up your own mind whether you prefer the psalm without these verses or just keep blabbering them together without looking at their meaning and find yourself praying some pretty dreadful things. You ready? Mm-hmm. Are you game? Mm-hmm. Psalm 5 verse 9 reads, as you find it in the psalm book and in your missal, there's no truth in their accusations. Inside they're only empty caverns. Their throats are wide open graves. All honey their speech. The psalm in the next verse goes on to say, but you won't find it in the missal, my God, make them suffer the consequences of their sin. Bring to nothing their plotting. Because of their many transgressions, cast them out for their rebelling against you. Can you hear in there, love your enemies? Can you hear it echoing? I don't think so. Anyway, they're not in the liturgy. Psalm 11 verse 5 reads in the psalmody and in the missal, the Lord tests the faithful and the wicked and rejects the lover of violence. Not perfect, but you can see the point being made. Maybe verse 6, could they have left it out? They haven't. You read it in the missal, but had they asked my advice, I would have suggested they leave it out. God sends coals of fire and sulphur on the wicked. A scorching wind will be their lot. You may not agree with me, but I don't find that all that helpful to pray. Here's Psalm 21, verse 6 and 7, found in the psalmody and in the missal, and then I'm going to suggest the next few verses, not me, I mean the church has dropped these verses out as being unfitting for worship. So firstly, the bits that are in the missal, 21, verse 6 and 7, you fill the king with joy in your presence, for the king trusts in the Lord. Through the kindness of the Most High, he shall not waver. And the bit that follows has been omitted by the church from our liturgy. Lord, you will deal with your enemies when suddenly you appear. You devour them in your anger. Your fire consumes them. You destroy their offspring from the earth, for they plotted against you, but their evil schemes did not succeed. You made them turn and run from the deadly aim of your arrows. You can see how that would have been prayed back in the ancient times before they knew Jesus, and while they had an idea of God as the angry and punishing God who won't stand to have foreigners attacking his people. Psalm 28, verse 3 is in the book, in the Psalms. Verse 4 has been dropped out. Verse 3, do not drag me away with the wicked, O Lord, with those who speak peace to their neighbours while mischief is in their hearts. The next verse, not found in our missal. Repay them according to the evil they do. Give them what they deserve. they have no regard for what the Lord is doing, God will break them down forever. You can imagine people who prayed that psalm at the time of Jesus being bewildered by Jesus' behaviour, which doesn't fit with that. Eating with sinners, embracing lepers, etc. Psalm 31, verse 15 and 16 are in our missal. Verse 17 and 18 have been dropped out by the church, I think wisely. 31:15 first. Rescue me from my enemies. Ruthlessly they hunt me down. Show your servant your radiant face. In your kindness save me. Beautiful prayer. 17 and 18, maybe not so beautiful for Christians to pray. Don't let me suffer shame for having called on you, my Lord. May the wicked be ashamed. Let them go in silence to the grave. Let the lying lips be stilled, lips that speak insolently against the just. Understandable in the book of Psalms. Not sounding perhaps so good from the lips of a Christian. Psalm 35. First three verses in the psalm book and in the church's liturgy. Verses 4, 5, 6, 7 and 8. Have been dropped out by the church, I think wisely. Firstly, the bit that's in the Psalms, prayed by the Jewish community and by the Christian assembly. Lord, plead my cause against my foes. Fight those who fight against me. Take up buckler and shield. Rise to my defence. Block the way against my pursuers. Say to me, I'm your deliverer. We'll all want to pray that. But thanks to the church's wisdom, we're not asked to pray the next bit. Let those who seek my life be put to shame. Make them retreat in disgrace. Let them be like chaff before the wind. Let their way be dark and slippery with the angel of the Lord in pursuit. Without cause they hid their net to catch me. For no good reason they dug a pit to take my life. Well, let ruin come on them unawares. Let the net that they've have hid ensnare them. Let them fall into the pit to their own ruin. Psalm 35. Again, the first three verses I'll read to you are in the Christian liturgy and in the Jewish Psalms. The next verses have been left out. Lord, you see it all. Don't be silent. Lord, don't be distant from me. Wake, stir yourself in my defence. Take my cause, my God and my Lord. Vindicate me, Lord, my God, according to your justice. We're invited to pray that by the church from these beautiful psalms of the ancient Jewish community. But we're not invited to pray the next two verses. Don't let them have the last word. Don't let them think, ha, we have what we have always been wanting. We've finished you off. No, let all those who rejoice at my calamity be put to shame and confusion. Let those who exalt themselves against me be clothed in shame and dishonour. I'm not boring you, I'm just trying to give you a taste for what's happened. And then make a few, I only made one suggestion so far, I'll have another to make in a minute. Psalm 40, verse 13 is beautifully repeated in our missals. Lord, please free me. Lord, make haste to help me. And then those who drew up our liturgy thought it good to leave verse 14 and 15 out, which read, let all those who seek my life be put to shame and confusion. Let those who desire to harm me be repulsed and disgraced. Let those who say to me, ha, ha, remain aghast because of their shame. And now an example of one that I think I would have liked to have been there when they made this decision and said, look, I think you can drop those verses too. But they're in there and you make your own mind up. It's Psalm 149, and I've skipped a lot. I'm not giving you the full list. But Psalm 149, verse 5 and 6, we pray with the psalm. Take your rest, sing for joy. Let the praises of our God resound on your lips. We also pray the rest. Should we? Well, you make up your own mind. This is Psalm 149, verse 6 to verse 9. Brandish swords in your hand to execute vengeance on the nations and punishment on the peoples, to bind their kings in chains and their nobles in fetters of iron, to execute on them the judgment decreed. This is your glory, you, the faithful of God, forever sing God's praise. Because you've grabbed a sword and you have slaughtered your enemies. We pray that psalm every Sunday at Lord's and every feast day. They grace us with that. And as you're in the chapel praying that with all your beautiful Christian heart, if I was kneeling next to you, would you forgive me if I just went silent and let you go on with it? Finally, and only a couple more minutes, the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation in Alexandria of the Hebrew Bible, because in Alexandria, the Jews that went there for the last 150 years or so, they speak in Greek, of course. They don't understand Hebrew. So they got together over there, the scholars, and created a, inverted commas, translation of the Hebrew text into Greek. The work of translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek began in the 3rd century BC and continued through to the early decades of the 1st century BC. So over a long period. Not only did the work continue for over a century and was therefore carried out by different translators, it also happened in different places, but especially in Alexandria and in Jerusalem. The title Septuagint is given to the body of early Greek translations of the Hebrew Bible. The first books to be translated were the books of the Torah, and the translation tends to be quite literal. In the case of the other books, the translation tends to be fairly free. So they were a bit later, different authors, and they gave the gist of it rather than perhaps word-for-word accuracy. The title Septuagint is based on a legend which is found in a book which is available called The Letter of Aristeas. It's a fictional letter. It describes, because are Jews going to be confident they're reading the sacred text? In our Catholic community, we kept Latin long after the sensible people, Luther and the rest, realised that the Bible's meant to be. So they read it out in their own language. We didn't. We were careful of it. We didn't quite understand, so we kept it in Latin right through to my lifetime and yours. So when the Bible comes in Greek, it's going to be a, how are you going to make it accepted by the Jews and read by them and understood by them and lived by them? Well, this letter of Aristeas describes how 72 scholars were selected to translate from the Hebrew. Now, they were all separate, and each one of the 72 produced his own translation. And miraculously, all the translations were identical. Well, if that isn't from God, what is? How are you going? I don't think you're meant to believe this, but that was the story, and people thought, wow. So they kind of accepted the text. This was surely proof of divine inspiration and could be used as an argument against those who were scandalized that people would dare to render God's inspired word in a language other than the sacred language of Hebrew. One has to be careful. I end with this, but it's a final warning. I had to learn to be careful, so maybe you do too. When comparing the Septuagint, the Greek translation, let's say from about the year 200 BC, because that becomes, of course, the translation, the quotes that are in the New Testament, are nearly all from the Septuagint, because it's written in Greek, the New Testament, so they took the Greek Bible. So the Septuagint becomes the whole lot of the Septuagint becomes the Bible for the Christian community spreading throughout the Greek-speaking world, including Rome, which spoke Greek in those days. So that's obvious, and it becomes the book of the church. Well, we have to be careful when comparing the Septuagint to the standard Hebrew Masoretic text, the origins of which lie in the late 1st century AD, when the rabbis set out to produce a standard text, Hebrew text. Sometimes, when the Septuagint and the Masoretic text differ, we may be witnessing errors in translation into the Greek. Or we may be watching influences of Hellenism on anyone attempting to translate texts from one culture to another in a meaningful way. Sometimes the Masoretic text may point to a Hebrew manuscript that includes editorial elements that post-date the manuscripts used by the authors of the Septuagint as a basis for their translation. Maybe there never was what we could call an original text. Different people copied it, different rabbis in different places, updated it there and here. So maybe there never was what we're able to call an original written text. Sometimes when the Hebrew and Greek texts differ, it's the Hebrew editors who are responsible for the errors that can be proven, not the Greek. So every time scholars find a difference between the Septuagint, the Greek, and the Hebrew, they have to look at each text and weigh up the probabilities of which one was more original than the other. I don't expect you to be able to do it, I certainly couldn't, but I've studied it in such a way to see plenty of people who are doing it. I'll conclude this now.